I'm John Kroll. Today on this special recorded No Limits, we're going to talk with Roger Ferguson. He's the president and CEO of TIAA. We're going to talk about retirement. We're going to talk about the economy. We're going to talk about the challenges facing Hoosiers and Americans as they move through these interesting and yet turbulent economic times. Because this is a recorded program, we are not able to take your questions or comments by phone, by email, by Facebook, or by Twitter. But we do hope that you enjoy the conversation. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. This is a special pre-recorded No Limits. We're going to be talking with Roger Ferguson, who's the president and CEO of TIAA CREF. And because this is a recorded program, we're not going to be able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you enjoy the conversation. Roger, welcome to Indianapolis.
Great. Nice to be here, and thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, certainly. It's good to have you here. So I'll start. We're going to start micro and then go to the macro here. Let's talk a little bit about at least the way most people perceive TIAA CREF as a retirement planning service, and talk about, if you could, offer some counsel on what people should be thinking about as they plan for retirement.
Sure, happy to do it, and you're right. The legacy of our great company is that it is a retirement-oriented company. We've been around 100 years, actually now 101 years. The vision of Andrew Carnegie, who was on the board of Cornell, saw all those faculty members retiring into poverty and thought we should do something. So that was his vision, and now here we are 100 years later, and we manage about $1.2 trillion of people's hard-earned money. So you ask what people should be thinking about as they're planning for and saving for retirement. They should think about a number of things. First, they should recognize that retirement is going to be, for many, many people, 10, 15, 20, maybe even 30 years. So it's not their grandfather's retirement over a few years. Mm-hmm. And that means that you have to really plan for it quite differently. First, while you're working, you have to make sure that you're saving an adequate amount. That starts by signing up for your employer's retirement plan, putting in the maximum amount. If there's a match, making sure you get the match. And as you get raises, make sure you continue to save more and more. A larger percentage of your income or certainly larger dollar amount. So that's item one. Join the plan and save. Item two, recognize that you're in it for the long term. And so don't watch your retirement account every month and think I should move in, move out, whatever it may be. Don't react to market ups and downs. Recognize that this is a long-term game that you're in terms of retirement and retirement savings. Third thing is to also have a sense of what your risk profile is likely to be. You know, there's some people who can tolerate the ups and downs of markets better than others, and you should just be mindful of that. Fourth point, be broadly diversified over the kind of period that you're saving for. Hard to know which kinds of asset classes are going to be stronger or weaker, what's going to go up, what's going to go down. So be broadly diversified. And then two last points, make sure you do what's called rebalancing every year. And so every year you look at your portfolio just once a year, maybe on your birthday, and say, well, gee, I've now got too much equity exposure, not enough of these other things, and think about rebalancing. And the last bit of advice is don't feel you have to do this on your own. Work with a really good, trusted advisor who's got your interest at heart.
So, obviously, $1.3 trillion in assets and all of that, TIAA CREF is a major player. How have things changed in helping people plan for retirement the decade? I think you alluded to one of them, the fact that retirement is no longer a 5 or 6 year problem. It can be a 25 or 30 year problem.
A number of things have changed over a period of time that we've been in business. First, you put your finger on one of them, which is longevity has gone up, which is a net good thing, but it does mean that you have to plan for a longer retirement. The second thing that's changed is there's been a real reflection and understanding that the kinds of investments that make sense if you're saving for a retirement might have changed or evolved. So at the very beginning, I would describe it in the old days, there's a notion that retirees should take, you know, very, very little risk and only put their money into fixed income investments. And then we've now come to recognize, starting about 60 or 70 years ago, that equity investments are really an important component of retirement retirement savings for individuals. The third thing that we've come to recognize is that even past equity and bonds, there are also other kinds of asset classes, real estate and what's called alternative investments. We at TIA offer those in the form of our real estate separate account, for example. Another big change is the world of retirement used to be, for most people, around something called defined benefit plans. You'd start at a company, you'd stay there forever, and they'd promise to, you know, pay you a percentage of your base salary when you retired. That is now pretty much a thing of the past for most, and so we've moved into a world of what's called defined contribution plans, in which individuals have to save for themselves, and then what they have in retirement depends very much on how much they've contributed. And that's been, you know, a dramatic shift. Mm-hmm. And the final shift, and it's implied in what we've been talking about, is we've gone from a place where employers would paternalistically take care of employees to a place where much of the risk and decision-making has been put on the employees. You know, how much to save, what to invest in, how do we plan to get the money out at the end. So there have been a number of dramatic changes in the way America thinks about retirement over the last 15, 20, 30 or 40 years.
How has that changed the way you folks have to do your jobs?
Well, the reality is our system has not been forced to change very much because we started 100 years ago in this notion of employees save, employers save, we do the investing, and then we pay people when they get to retirement. So in some ways, what's happening is the retirement model is, in a good sense, when it works well, moving in the direction that we've already pioneered, because we're one of the first plans that had both these defined contribution and defined benefit elements associated with it. The final point I'd make about what we do that's so important is that we create at the end, through the use of an annuity, the ability to get a paycheck for retirement. And you know, that is a very, very important element that's missing in many plans that's central to who we are and what we stand for. And so that's really something that I think we pioneered and indeed is critical to our ability to help people get safely to and through retirement.
Well, and that's the other direction I want to take this at the micro level is we talk an awful lot about how you should plan for retirement. The other question is, how should you responsibly be retired?
Right. And that is a central question. So we've already talked about the many years that one might be in retirement, 20 or 30 years. So what do you have to do to responsibly be in retirement? I think one of the most important elements is to figure out how you're going to have the equivalent of a retirement paycheck, so to speak. And so for us, that means putting some of your money into a so-called annuity where we, the company, you know, guarantees that we'll pay you, you know, according to the agreements that we make with you every quarter, every month, every week, whatever it may be. And that's really important. The second thing to recognize about planning for being in retirement is that, you know, some of your expenses will be quite predictable, you know, the mortgage, et cetera. Room and board, whatever it may be. Some of them might be quite unpredictable. You know, this year you want to take a fancy vacation, next year you don't. And so you have to plan for both the predictable and the unpredictable. The way we do that in our company is we have two varieties of annuities. We have what's called the fixed annuity, and we recommend that you annuitize some of your money in that mode to take care of the things that are quite predictable. And then have the variable annuity, which will go up and down with the stock market. And in good years, you have a bit more money for, you know, discretionary expenditures, and other years, you don't, you know, take that fancy vacation. Maybe you do a staycation. So that's the second thing to think about in planning for retirement. The third thing to think about is there's this notion that when you get into retirement, your lifetime expenses go way down. And we're starting to understand that, indeed, while you have fewer expenses, you know, living in retirement is still not as inexpensive as people have often thought. And so you need to think about replacing around 70% of your pre-retirement income is what most economists say. And for many people, that's a novel thought. To summarize, retirement may be longer than you expect. You need some guaranteed income to the point of an annuity. And you have to recognize that the amount of income that you're going to need may be about 70% of what you really were making when you were still working.
If you're just joining us, this is a special recorded No Limits. We're talking with Roger Ferguson, who's the president and CEO of TIAA CREF. And we're talking about retirement, and we're going to be talking soon about larger economic issues. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the discussion. So we'll get down to brass tacks here. If people want to retire at, say, 65, how much should they have saved or set aside?
Well, very good question, which is not a single magic answer,
I figured that, yeah.
Roughly speaking, retirement economists say you should save somewhere around 10% of your income every year in a retirement form. Now, that should be partially what you as an individual put aside and partially what your employer puts aside. And so those numbers, 10-12%, mm-hmm. rough rule of thumb kind of activity. But it's a good place to start. Now, the final element of that one is make sure you get some good advice. Mm-hmm. And you know, a good advisor can model exactly what you need, what's relevant to your particular case. But one should think in that 10-12% of pre-retirement income being saved every year in order to have enough of a nest egg for a good, solid retirement.
What are the biggest mistakes people make in preparing for retirement?
Unfortunately, there's a litany of mistakes that people make in preparing for retirement. First is they often don't sign up for their employer's retirement plan. So in the private sector, only about 50% of people actually have access to and are using a retirement plan. The second mistake they make is they don't save enough. One should at least save enough to get the so-called match, because that is, you know, doubling your money free. The third mistake that people often make is they either are overly conservative or maybe even, you know, inappropriately aggressive. So a lot of folks think, gee, this is my retirement nest egg. I don't want to take any risk with it, so I'm only going to invest in riskless fixed income assets. The problem there is the rate of return is not necessarily going to be very high. And there are other folks who say, you know, I'm going to shoot for the moon and, you know, hope for the best, and they do the most speculative. Mm-hmm. So you need sort of a middle ground. And then the two other mistakes that people make is there's a little bit of set it and forget it. So the decisions that they may have made when they're 25, they need to review every year just to see how things are going. And then finally, they make the mistake of not thinking about how they're actually going to take the money out. Mm-hmm. At the end. So they get very focused on, you know, the size of the saving nest egg, and then they get to retirement and then they don't really think about how they're going to take the money out to pay for their lifetime income in retirement.
You've said a couple of times that they ought to look for a trusted financial advisor, someone to give them counsel. What sort of qualities should they look for in that person?
Expertise and knowledge, obviously. A certain amount of objectivity. And an individual who is going to listen and understand, you know, how you imagine your retirement unfolding and give you good advice on what actually might happen. And most importantly, don't fall for some person who says, gee, you know, I know how to beat the market. You know, my portfolio only goes up every year. You know, and you know, there are always those next door neighbors and brothers-in-law who claim they have just made a huge fortune. And, you know, be a little skeptical of things that sound too good to be true.
Where are the places you should look for those folks then, assuming it's not the next-door neighbor or the brother-in-law?
Well, look, I think certainly for those of us, for those in Indiana who save with TIAA, we provide, you know, that kind of advice. But I'd say broadly speaking, you have to go to, you know, a well-established, well-regarded financial services firm. And again, you know, I emphasize for those who have worked with TIAA, please come and talk to our advisors.
And is there a charge for that if they do?
No, for us, there is no charge at this stage. For other people, you know, I don't know what other companies might do, but one should absolutely look and ask that very important question of how much am I paying for, you know, the advice that I'm getting.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Roger Ferguson, who's the president and CEO of TIAA CREF. I keep wanting to do only one A in there and slide over that. We've been talking largely about how you prepare for retirement and how you enjoy retirement. We're going to move to larger economic questions and issues when we come back from the break. This is a recorded program, which means that we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. But we do hope that you have been enjoying the conversation. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today in this special recorded No Limits with Roger Ferguson, who is the president and CEO of TIAA. We have been talking about retirement, but we're going to talk about larger economic issues in this segment. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying and profiting from the discussion. So, Roger, now that we've dealt with helping people plan for their own retirements, let's talk a bit about the sort of stuff I would think in your job that might keep you awake at night right now. What are, as you see it, are the larger economic challenges in front of us?
So thanks for the question. There are a number of economic issues and challenges in front of us. But we should start with the grounding that this year, everyone expects that this recovery that we've had will get to be the longest in the economic history of the United States. So it's a fascinating point that we've come through what has been, frankly, generally speaking, at a macro level, very good times economically. We've seen that play out in terms of the jobless rate coming down to historically low levels. Wages are now finally starting to pick up just a little bit, and inflation is very low and stable and contained. So at a big macro picture, one would say, wow, we've come through a really strong time. Similarly, the stock market has come through a really long time as well. As we are talking today and over the next month or so, the stock market will meet, will hit the 10th anniversary of a very long recovery. So we should, first put a positive check mark around, the positive things that have occurred. Having said that, we've seen recently more volatility in equity markets, and many think that that's going to continue for the next period of time. And the reason is that the broader macroeconomic environment, growth, unemployment, et cetera, also are showing some issues that are starting to get people to question, well, how much longer are these really good times going to run? And some of the things that people are concerned about, one is the U.S. is likely to continue to grow, but maybe not as quickly as we have over the last couple of years. Secondly, we see in the global economy, again, a little bit of slowing. Europe seems to be slowing. Some of the major economies there may already be contracting a little bit, maybe in mild recession. Because it's a global market, we also have to think about China. They are a major exporter, and we're seeing them slow down, which is having an impact in some other economies. And so many folks, as we look over the next two or three years, are saying, stock market likely be a bit more volatile, maybe economy slowing a little bit. The odds of recession, though no one is saying it's a certainty, seem to have gone up for 2020, 2021, out a little bit over the horizon. And so it feels a little bit like a somewhat more volatile and rocky time than what we've had in the past. What does this mean for individuals? And we've been talking about retirement. For most individuals, they should try to not stay heavily focused on the ups and downs in the market. Particularly if you're a retirement saver, you're planning for 15, 20, 30 years, the ups and downs of the next 2 years should not really be central to your thinking. But you should recognize it's likely to happen and not be surprised if we see some days when the market has big gyrations up or down, which started to occur, you know, October, November of 2018. And we'll see, I suspect, a bit more of that going forward.
Do you worry about political volatility at all? I mean, the fact that, you know, we've got a basically a gyroscope as a political system right now.
There's no doubt that some of the economic volatility we're seeing is being driven by, you know, political kinds of decisions. So the largest one is Brexit, the exit of the UK from the European Union or parts of it. And people worry about, you know, how that's going to unfold. It's not yet clear that it's going to be a smooth and easy Brexit. There are some people worry about a hard Brexit or no Brexit. And, you know, what does that mean for Europe, which is one of the largest you know, economic blocs in the world, in some ways larger than the United States. People are obviously also trying to understand the trade discussion between the U.S. and China. You know, that swings back and forth. And the U.S. stock market is very attuned to the headlines that come out of there. You know, if it looks like good progress is being made, the market tends to rally. If there is some concern that maybe this discussion is a little rougher than maybe people would fear, this negotiation, the market seems to come off. And so that's a intersection of politics and economics and the market for sure. Though it's not central yet to the way markets react, some of the concerns around oil markets, for example, and uncertainty in the Middle East, uncertainty in Venezuela, all those things also play in. So there's no doubt that the macroeconomic conditions and the markets are always to some degree touched by politics.
Do you worry about the debt? A few years ago, there were movements even here in Indiana to try to call a new constitutional convention to deal with, you know, putting curbs on debt. Those discussions here have largely gone away, but you know, with the tax cuts, we added another $1 trillion to the debt. Is that something people should be worrying about?
I think it's something people should pay attention to. And the reason is that, as you point out, we now are running at the federal level deficits of about $1 trillion a year. Mm-hmm. We are now seeing our debt starting to get to about 75% of the U.S. GDP, which for us is a very large number. And the reason I think people should really be focused on this links back to an earlier discussion that we had, which is mm-hmm. that we are in a world of aging population here in the U.S. and globally. That means that the expenses from the federal government around Medicare and Social Security, if anything, are only going to rise. Mm-hmm. And some of that may have to be paid for by issuing debt. And so I think all of us need to be mindful of the degree of debt, the deficit that we're running every year, the degree of debt, and what that means about the flexibility that the U.S. government has over the next 10, 15 years to deal with the various obligations that are already being built up in the system.
Now, I'm probably going to oversimplify his argument more than he would care for, but Paul Krugman has argued in the past that of the New York Times has argued that we shouldn't be overly concerned about the debt because it's largely a debt we owe ourselves. That is there anything to that line of thinking?
Look, this is a line of thinking that not just Paul but others have communicated. It's got a fancy name now, being called modern monetary theory. Mm-hmm. And it's very controversial. I would say that there are many of us who think, well, let's be a little skeptical about saying that the amount of deficit or the size of the deficit and the size of the debt don't matter, because we've never been in the place where we've seen an expectation that this continues to grow and grow and grow and grow. And one has to really be mindful that much of our debt is being held by individuals outside of the United States. And so it's a real reflection that they have a lot of confidence in us and they're willing to save their money in U.S. dollar securities. But there's no guarantee that that's going to continue forever as the amount of the debt continues to grow. So I respect the fact that, you know, we have right now an ability to borrow at relatively low interest rates, but we don't know if there's going to be a breaking point at some point where, you know, citizens of other countries say, well, gee, I would much prefer to hold my money in my own currency and not in the U.S. Currency. So I think we should be cautious and not presume that we can just borrow to multiples of the current GDP. There's no evidence that would support that kind of profligacy. And so I think we should be a little more prudent, a little more cautious.
How about the trade deficit? There were headlines, a few weeks ago that we'd set a record. Is that a source? And there's a lot of dispute there about whether that should be a source of concern or not. It is to the president. Other folks are saying not so much. Where do you land on that?
Well, most economists would say that what's called the bilateral trade deficits don't matter. Between the United States and one particular country is not central to a recognition of the health of the U.S. economy. More broadly, most people would say that running, as we have for long, long periods of time, a significant deficit tells us something about the imbalances in our own economy. Mm-hmm. And what they tell us is, or what those deficits tell us, is that we are probably consuming too much, most importantly, saving and investing too little. And so it's not the size of the deficit per se that mm-hmm. says there's something that we need to worry about. It is really the underlying cause, which is, we should probably be saving and investing a bit more, reining in our consumption a little bit. Other countries, particularly China, for example, probably should be consuming a bit more and saving a little bit less. So the issue around the deficit is not so much the size of it. It is what it tells us about our own economic behaviors in the U.S. and in other countries. And there's no doubt that we probably should be saving more, putting more into education, putting more into infrastructure, planning for the future. That includes, Social Security payments, et cetera. So if I look at it and say, this is telling us that we need to sort of change at a macro level, maybe at a micro level, our own economic behaviors a little bit.
If you're just joining us, this is a special recorded No Limits. We're talking with Roger Ferguson, who is the president and CEO of TIAA. Because it is a recorded program, we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. So you talked a little bit earlier about how, in many ways, the economy looked robust, that, many of the indicators. One of the things we have seen here in Indiana, and it's not a problem specific to Indiana, in recent years, other parts of the country as well, is that even though we are pretty close, if not at the economist's definition of full employment in the state, we also have seen poverty rates increasing. And you alluded, obviously, to the economic disparities, the fact that the gap seems to be growing. Is that one of the biggest long-term sources? I don't want to use the word threat, but long-term sources of concern that we should be focusing on?
I think it absolutely is one of the biggest long-term sources of concern, and maybe even threat might not be too strong a word.
Okay.
A couple of things to understand. First is the income inequality that we've been talking about started, the data show, about 40 years ago, believe mm-hmm. it or not. We started to see a gradual, now much bigger, gap. And income between the top 1%, so to speak, and the rest of the population. It started to show up in a way that was a bit of a conundrum to most economists, which was, why was it that median income seemed not to be rising mm-hmm. very much more than inflation? It had been relatively flat for 10, 15, 20 years. Second kind of inequality that we should be aware of is there's also even more inequality when it comes to wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And that matters because that creates intergenerational issue from one generation to the next, some problems. So I do think we have to really come to grips with this question of income inequality. We are increasingly having society of the haves and the have-nots.
Mm-hmm.
And if we aren't careful, society is going to look a little bit like the old Gilded Ages in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
You're anticipating my next question there because we haven't seen disparities like this really since the Industrial Revolution took off. What do we do about it?
Well first,
maybe the first question is, how did we get here?
Well, we got here for a reason that you implied by saying it's like the Industrial Revolution. So what we have seen is whenever the fundamental economics of equation evolved dramatically
mm-hmm.
From the agrarian economy to the industrial economy, now for us from the industrial economy to an information economy, there seem to be haves and have-nots that emerge because there are pockets in the population who can take advantage of the new technologies and those who do less so. Second point, if we look back at the Gilded Age and the Industrial Age, et cetera, it should give us some hope that, though it's not immediate, over time society figures out how to right itself. And if you think about it, the industrial era that started with so many haves and have-nots ended up creating vast wealth and bringing millions of people into a middle class, which should give us a little bit of sense of hope. Then the third issue is, well, what is it that mm-hmm. creates that? And what we see is, unfortunately, it takes some time, but the right balance of infrastructure investments, education, appropriate tax policy, all those things have to come to appropriate regulation. All those things have to come together to create an environment in which the kind of wealth that's being created gets shared a little bit more equally, and everybody has a real shot at rising from lower socioeconomic status to middle to upper. So one should not give up hope, but one should also recognize that it requires some new models of thinking. It requires, frankly, maybe a bit of a new social compact, so to speak. And it's not easy to come by those things. So if you think about the Industrial Age, Teddy Roosevelt, one of my great heroes, mm-hmm. managed to create a combination of capitalism and the progressive movement that made capitalism safe, so to speak, for the vast majority of Americans and kicked off this move towards creating a big middle class out of this industrial era.
Is the ethos in one and in some ways both political parties for a generation has been that you can do more with less, that taxes by definition are an abomination. I hear you saying, though, we ought to be reinvesting in some things. Do we need to work our way out of that cul-de-sac and redefine the conversation about government?
No, I think we do. I think, like it or not, I think we're really in the midst of that conversation now. And not everyone is very happy with the tone and the way it's played out. But I do think we need to, sort of define, all right, what is the role of government? How much are we willing to tax ourselves? What are we thinking about in terms of, creating opportunity for everybody? What are we thinking about in terms of redistribution? And I'm not here to sort of say, mm-hmm. there is an answer. Mm-hmm. I'm here to say that, like it or not, our generation is confronting these really tough kinds of questions. And what I think we're observing, as unpleasant as it is different models sort of competing and trying to come to a consensus view of how do we actually move forward, knowing that we cannot have the kind of democracy that we all value, a representative democracy in which so many folks are feeling left behind and it feels like a small number are really winning. And so we're in the midst of that debate now. It's really unpleasant, but it's a debate that must be had if we are actually going to make the world a better place for our kids and our grandkids.
Do you see that as the central debate and challenge of our time?
I think I do. I mean, that has many pieces underneath it, obviously. But I think the central debate is how are we going to make the new norms in terms of capitalism, call it a more information-led, more technologically-led global capitalism, work for the vast majority of Americans, just as we figure out how to make an industrial world work for the vast majority of Americans, which it didn't do at the very beginning. So, I think it is the central debate of our time because we want to enjoy the fruits of a highly productive economy that is potentially ahead of us because of these new technologies, these new ways of doing work, because of the vast majority of information that we have, because of globalization. We have to figure out how to turn all those things into a positive. And right now, I think for a few people, they are a big positive. For some people, for many people, they feel more like a threat and a negative. And it's up to all of us to figure out how we're going to confront that and turn that thing that feels like a negative into something that feels much more positive and hopeful for many millions of Americans.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Roger Ferguson, the president and CEO of TIAA. This is a recorded No Limits, which means we're not able to take calls, emails, or answer your questions or deal with your comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. When we come back, we're going to talk about how all of these large economic changes are going to be changing people's lives. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today in this special recorded No Limits with Roger Ferguson, who is the president and CEO of TIAA. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take your calls, your emails, or your questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. The last segment, we talked about sort of macroeconomic and political challenges, concerns, in some cases opportunities. We're going to bring that back around right now because one of the things that I've seen most often, Roger, is a growing consensus among economists that we are entering into a period in which there will be a worldwide labor shortage. That they're saying by 2030, it could be 20 to 25%. I want to start by talking about how that is going to affect retirement planning, because one would assume that there are going to be tremendous incentives to keep skilled people working beyond the age of 65 or 70, and how you and TIAA are going to have to adapt to that new reality, and how the people you serve are going to have to adapt to it.
So I'm happy to start at that place, and I think we should look at this as good news. And so the increased longevity, one should think of as a longevity dividend, so to speak. And we ought to figure out how to use that dividend. I actually think that having older people staying in the workforce longer is a net positive. It's a net positive for them because they've built up a lot of what we economists call human capital and shouldn't suddenly be sidelined because they've reached a certain age. I think it's a net positive for their colleagues. The other folks in the workforce can learn a lot from, all of us aging baby boomers who have 20 or 30 or 40 years of experience, and I would even use the word wisdom. Mm-hmm. Without getting too technical, there's a German economist who has studied intergenerational teams of older people and younger people in a manufacturing setting in Germany, and has found that they tend to be more productive than teams that have either just older folks or just younger folks, mm-hmm. showing that there's a real productivity dividend from having cross-generational older and younger folks mixed together in diverse teams. And so I think it's a very, very, very good thing. Frankly, as a retirement person oriented to retirement in my job now, mm-hmm. The fact that people stay at work a little longer and allows them to save even more is a net positive. And we see an awful lot of psychological evidence that older individuals engaged get more fulfillment out of life. So I think there are many reasons, both economically, financially, and even in the softer social psychology area, for individuals to stay working for a much longer period of time. The challenge around that is you also want to make sure that the perception doesn't start to creep in that older people are sort of stifling the progress of younger people. There's a fallacy that exists that there are only a certain number of jobs, and if older people are keeping them, then mm-hmm. younger people can't. One should recognize that, indeed, in good, healthy economies, new jobs are being created all the time. Older jobs are disappearing, and the economies are expanding. So the goal of having older people staying in is to make the society itself more productive, and hopefully that allows the creation of new jobs that everyone can take, including younger people just entering the workforce.
Are we going to have to start getting more creative about how we deal with this challenge? I'm thinking about in this state, during the break, we were alluding to the fact that, this was Indiana, like much of the Midwest, was an industrial stronghold. But when the Industrial Revolution came to an end, there's been sort of a slow progression of jobs away. And a lot of people who keep longing for a sense of occupation and a lifestyle that may not be possible anymore, at least doing the kinds of things they did. And we haven't done as many practical things to help them retrain or retrench their careers. Are we going to have to start thinking about that much more seriously now?
We're going to have to certainly start thinking about it much more seriously. A couple of things. One is we're going to have to figure out how to leverage technologies in a way that allows older people to be more productive. So we're quite anxious about artificial intelligence, for example. We're mm-hmm. quite anxious about robots and robotics. And we should also be asking the other side, well, what's the upside? Can we use artificial intelligence? Can we use robotics? Can we use information technology in a way that complements and supports what mm-hmm. older workers can do and help, you know, retrain individuals from one industry to another? So for sure, we have to think more seriously about it. The other thing, frankly, is we also have to be grounded in reality that, you know, some individuals are removed from where the jobs are. So can we use technologies to allow people to work in a more virtual environment, so to speak? So a question around infrastructure is, we normally think of infrastructure as being roads and mm-hmm. highways and things of that sort. But there's also infrastructure that comes with the Internet and, mm-hmm. you know, being connected so that one can work, you know, in a variety of different locations, allowing folks to stay in smaller towns, maybe more rural areas or areas that have been sort of deindustrialized and still work, you know, with companies that are maybe in larger locations, instead of making people physically move. So we should think about infrastructure that brings the last mile and has everyone being sort of connected, so to speak. And then the final point is, you know, we're also going to have to recognize there will be a class of individuals who we just really can't retrain, and how are we going to mm-hmm. think about giving them dignity? Mm-hmm. And I can't claim to have to answer those questions, but, you know, think about it in all three dimensions, using technology, getting people linked, and also for a small group of people, you know, recognize that maybe we can't really create for them the same kinds of jobs. So, you know, what can we do to give dignity? And so those are some of the big social questions that we have to deal with.
Is there something, even in the fact that we've done a show, for example, with a couple of the guys from Carrier here, and one of the things that that stuck in my head is one of the guys said, yeah, I'd love to get retrained. I'd love to do something else. But it's not like, you know, when I lost my job, I had to go out and find another one that pays, you know, a lot less. And I have to work even more hours, you know, to provide for my family. So I just I don't have the time and the energy to do that. Do we need to think in terms of subsidizing that re-education and retraining, creating ways, bridges for people with...
So the answer is yes, we do. And, you know, we have to choose the words carefully, right? So mm-hmm. we don't like talking about subsidizing and that kind of thing. But let's be very honest about it. Mm-hmm. We are going to have to figure out how to assist individuals bridging into, you know, newer roles if we can do that. And some of them will be able to succeed and some won't. And so we also need to figure out, you know, how we create a social safety net for those who can't, you know, quite succeed in doing that. Equally importantly, I'd say, though, you're closest than I am, I think part of the challenge is not just for that older individual who's wondering what he mm-hmm. or she is going to do, but it's also how they think about their kids and
yes.
the next generation.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Right? And so I think, you know, we have to sort of help them bridge. We also have to create, you know, models that bring, you know, the child of that displaced manufacturing worker into the modern society. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a little bit of both and. You may have a better feel for it than I do, but I think part of what I hear when I talk to the older worker who's found mm-hmm. his or her job is displaced is, well, what does this mean for my kid? Mm-hmm. You know, not necessarily what does it mean for me. So we have to think about, you know, the anxiety that a lot of people have about their children as well as the anxiety they have about their own futures.
And with this change, I mean, the fact that there are going to be demands for people to keep working longer, do we need to rethink the whole idea of retirement? I mean, right now there are all sorts of incentives set up, disincentives for you to save, you know, realistically, you can't get much past the age of 70, shielding your savings and all of that. Do we need to stretch that out some, or do we need to create, you know, a staggered system in which you can shield part of it but not all of it beyond 70? And
So the answer is yes.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So we have to recognize that the rules and the laws set around retirement now are all 30, 40 years old, or maybe in some cases older.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were not set up at a period when we have the kind of life expectancy that we currently have, and people really wanting to continue to work, et cetera. So without a doubt, I think part of the fix for the challenge that we're talking about is, as we said in one of the earlier segments, recognize that retirement has been redefined.
Mm-hmm.
And so the laws around retirement should be modernized to keep up with that. One of those things that is a bit technical, but is very, very important. In the earlier segment, we talked about the use of annuities as a way to guarantee income in retirement. We need to have a set of laws that really encourage the use of the annuity option, because that is the modern version of the pension. And there are a few laws in Congress now that, though fairly technical, I think start to drive this. So that's a place to look. The whole question of what's called required minimum distribution at the age of 70 1/2 has to be looked at again for sure. Now, whenever we say that, my friends who work in really tough, back-breaking jobs, what we call blue-collar or pink-collar jobs, have to remind us that there are folks who really can't work past 65. So we shouldn't get into a mindset that says, well, everyone's going to be able to work till they're 70 or 72. There are some folks who can't, so we need to be more nuanced about how we think about the retirement age with a little bit of flexibility, as you pointed out. To figure out how what retirement means for you as an individual versus the societal view of this is the retirement age and this is when you should start taking your money out.
Do you worry at all? One of the cliches of American politics is the talking about changing Social Security is like touching the third rail, that there's tremendous fears there. And some of that obviously is political, but also this is my perception. I'll identify it for the audience so that they can knock me down for it if they choose. But that there's also a tremendous cultural insecurity or uneasiness just about talking about getting older, period.
Look, I think all these things have some validity, right? No one wants to talk much about getting older, and that sort of talks about mortality and a bunch of issues that are difficult for individuals to deal with. Having said that, to take it back to Social Security, we need to start with a grounded reality, which is if we don't do something about Social Security by another 10 or 15 years from now, maybe 18 years from now, the Social Security Trust Fund will be in a place where it can no longer live up to 100% of its commitments. There's an expectation from the trustees that in about 2033, Social Security will only be able to pay out about 75% of its promised payments. So we should start with that as a grounded reality. The second reality is that young individuals, generally speaking, believe that Social Security won't be there for them at all. And so against the backdrop of those two harsh facts, I think we are going to have to come to grips with how are we going to reform Social Security. And we have to do it in a way that guarantees that those who are close to retirement aren't going to be damaged, so to speak, and that the system is shored up for those who are 30 or 40 years away from retirement, call them in their early 20s. And, all of us are going to have to recognize that, the status quo is really not sustainable. And then society's got to figure out, how do we adjust in a way that doesn't create the anxiety for those who are already retired or within a year or two, but also creates a greater sense of hope for those who are much younger.
Does that add weight to the challenge that you face? I mean, the fact that there is this widespread doubt about whether, at least that version of the social contract is going to be honored.
It doesn't really add weight exactly to what we do. We obviously talk about it with our participants, but recognize that the vast majority of folks who've been saving with us are in a very, very different place. They feel much more secure about their retirement. But we do have to recognize and tell them, what you might be able to get in Social Security, which is, for everyone a bit of a bedrock, might not be you know, what you had originally modeled a few years ago. So it's a little bit of both ends. Our participants are feeling highly secure about their retirement. By and large, they've saved enough. You know, most of our plans do quite well, the vast majority in terms of replacing the income, assuming people have saved, et cetera. So our audience is a little bit of a sort of isolated oasis in this uncertain world around retirement. And so as we think about it, it's a broader societal issue, less of an issue for our 5 million participants, the vast majority of whom are highly confident about their retirement prospects.
Are they anxious about anything? I mean, and what would those anxieties be? And then, you know, what are they hopeful about?
Our participants are, you know, one, generally speaking, hopeful. They tend to be, because we serve the not-for-profit sector, they tend to be, you know, reasonably well-educated, disproportionately better educated than most, since the vast majority of our folks are either in higher ed or in research or medical or cultural fields that tend to be reasonably well-educated. You know, with higher-than-average education also comes, you know, frankly, better physical health outcomes. And so our participants really are mainly thinking about, well, how do I get that guaranteed income for a retirement that could be, you know, even longer than the average? They're also asking themselves the questions, because they tend to be white-collar workers, not blue and pink-collar workers, well, how much longer should I work? And that's a little bit of a dilemma because, you know, many of them want to work till they're, you know, well into their 70s and maybe in some cases their 80s. Not clear that their employers always want to see that happen. And so we're having, you know, that discussion around what we call the, in our space, the reluctant retiree. And so those are some of the issues that our folks are dealing with. But I would say they are dealing with it in the sense of being much more optimistic and confident about retirement than the vast majority of Americans.
We're getting close on time and have maybe 45 seconds left. What's your last bit of counsel to people who are either planning for retirement or getting ready to retire now?
I think my last bit of counsel is to recognize that your retirement, that individual who's planning or getting ready to retirement, is going to be very unlike your grandfather's or your grandmother's retirement. It's going to last longer. You're going to have better health outcomes and therefore can be more active. And therefore, you really have to plan how you want to leverage the economic resources that you have in a way that's really responsible, that's going to last for 15, 20, or 30 years. And that does mean, you know, taking advantage of a guaranteed income option, being really smart about your fixed expenses and your variable expenses, and, as I said, getting really good advice for those who work with TIA from one of our advisors.
And that will have to be the last word. Roger Ferguson, I'd like to thank you for what's been an enlightening and, I got to say, from my perspective, invigorating conversation. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the air, Ricky.
Certainly. Also like to thank our listeners for joining us today. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.